This is the first part of our longer podcast on the narrative of the life of Frederick Douglass, an American slave. Today, I want to look at just the first two. If you've taken a look at the web pages, you've seen that that PDF that you can download about the structure and the movement in Douglass's autobiographical text. Those three big narrative embols, they're called, are the three things I really want to focus on: the beating of his aunt, the death of his grandmother, and then his escape. And as I'm going to say, at every big event, our expectations are manipulated and kind of overturned, right? Some of you may have read this in high school, maybe even grade school, but I want to look at this in a way that's beyond just, oh, here's an abolitionist who's arguing, or here's a guy who uses oratory in the same way that Whitman does, with rhythm and repetition that we're going to see over and over again in this text. I want to look at these three great setups for us, and, well, there are a couple of smaller ones as well, and how our expectations are subverted from that. So when the text begins, right, Douglass goes to great pains to emphasize that he doesn't know things. He doesn't know who his father is. He barely gets to see his mother. Most slaves don't know when their birthday is. He's not sure, right? It's this beginning in ignorance. And you could say at one level, that's setting us up for the idea of education that's going to come as the significant kind of keystone event later on in the text. But Douglass, especially in chapter one, talks about what he doesn't know, but he joins that with the idea that he is just like every other slave, right? He is not individuated at all. He represents the group. He's the, as we would say in religious studies, he's the type rather than the anti-type. So he begins this text in ignorance. He begins this text with the idea that slaves themselves are ignorant. Slaves as a group are ignorant. But as we're going to see, that ignorance isn't really real. There are some techniques that he's going to use, something that we call, as you saw in the thing, masking. This idea that keeping your real intentions and your real feelings hidden. We get a couple great examples of that later on. Both of them have to do, in fact, with songs. He talks about the slaves, the Great House Farm, and how they would sing and how they sang the most dolorous of ideas and the most rapturous of tones, and vice versa. So basically, the songs that sound happy are really about depressing or sad subjects, and the songs that sound really sad may actually carry content that's really very uplifting or joyful. So this trick here is it becomes known in African American studies as masking. This idea of keeping your true intentions hidden. Skip Gates, Henry Louis Gates Jr., who's at Harvard now, talks about that in terms of slavery and in Christianity. And believe me, Douglass is going to talk a lot about Christianity here. He says that the reason why slaves survived, the reason why slaves survived Christianity being forced on them, was, he said, we out-Jesus them. And that's part of what's going on here with this masking idea, is this idea that keep whites, keep slave owners, keep those in positions of power unaware of how you really feel, because they want you to act a certain way. They're not really that interested in how you feel. They're only interested in external appearances. So keep your feelings to yourself. When you think about that, those songs, what another thing Douglass says about them, he says, when you hear those songs, he says, I think they would do more to teach you about the abhorrent nature of slavery than any book of philosophy on the subject. Now, that's ultimately an incredibly romantic position, right? Because a song makes you feel, right? You can, obviously, a song is far more emotional than rational, right? He says logic may let you arrive at the conclusion that slavery is wrong. Obviously, it will. But the shortcut to get there is through this emotional experience, and that's what he's setting us up with the songs. Think of, if you know one slave song, you may have heard of the song Follow the Drinking Gourd, which is another prime example of masking. The idea that masters or overseers listening to slaves sing in the field about following the drinking gourd think that it's a song about, well, here comes a slave with a bucket of water and a ladle, usually a hollowed out gourd, a calabash or something, or squash, that you need to keep an eye on so you make sure that you get your water, that you basically, they're not thinking stay hydrated, but that you stay alive. And sure, masters, overseers, that's what they hear when they hear that song. What slaves hear when they hear that song is, that drinking gourd, that's not that thing being passed around the field. That thing is the Big Dipper that points to the North Star. Right? If you know a little bit about astronomy, if you know you can find the Big Dipper, you know that there are two stars, the pointer stars, at the tail end of the ladle that always point to Polaris, the North Star. It's advice for runaway slaves. Follow the drinking gourd. Always head north. If you're a runaway slave, you're not traveling in the daytime because you're too likely to be caught. You're not traveling on roads because you're too likely to be caught. You travel through the woods. You travel through fields. How do you keep your bearings, right? You can't see the sunrise and set. You don't really know, at least you're not traveling at that time. How do you know that you're continually moving north? You follow the drinking gourd. A prime example of masking there. And Douglas likes to play with our conventions like that. He's going to give us in that very first narrative, Emble, the beating of his aunt, he's going to give the lie to this idea that somehow slaves are ignorant. Because remember, when he sets us up in chapter one, he tells us that he is just like every other slave. He is just as kind of unaware of what's going on or of his surroundings as every other slave, right? As he says, it's all new to me. After he tells us the story of Aunt Hester, well, actually, I think it's before the story he tells us about Aunt Hester, we get the beating of his aunt, right? That starts right there in chapter one, I think. Talking about his master was a cruel man hardened by a long life of slaveholding. He would at times seem to take great pleasure in whipping a slave. I have often been awakened at the dawn of day by the most heartrending shrieks of an old aunt of mine, whom he used to tie up to a joist and whip upon her naked back till she was literally covered with blood. No words, no tears, no prayers from his gory victim seemed to move his iron heart from its bloody purpose. The louder she screamed, the harder he whipped, and where the blood ran fastest, there he whipped longest. He would whip her to make her scream and whip her to make her hush. And not until overcome by fatigue would he cease to swing the blood-clotted cowskin. Now, that is some brilliant writing right there. We can do some rhetorical analysis there and see that we've got lots of really complicated things going on there. But I'm more interested in what happens after that. I remember the first time I witnessed this, and he says, right, I was quite a child. It was the first of a long series of such outrages of which I was doomed to be witness and a participant. It struck me with awful force. It was the blood-stained gate, the entrance to the hell of slavery through which I was about to pass. And it's that last sentence there that's really, I think, most important there. It was the blood-stained gate, the entrance to the hell of slavery. He's making an allusion there. Right? This entrance to the hell of slavery, a gate that gets you into hell. Well, we could say it's a biblical allusion. We could talk about the harrowing of hell, but that's not specifically what he's talking about. He's making an allusion there to Dante's Inferno, 13th century Italian poet. Wait, didn't he just start telling us about what he didn't know and didn't know his birthday, and he's just like every other slave, and they're all right, kind of making sure that we know that they don't know things? Here's a guy who's alluding to Dante, just in the middle of the, you know, just here at the tail end of a paragraph. He's got it sitting there. What, you didn't catch that allusion? I'm willing to bet not many people do. But for an ignorant slave to allude to Dante like that? Dante's Inferno begins. And what does it say over the top of the entrance to hell in Dante's Inferno? Abandon hope, all ye who enter here. That is definitely the hell of slavery, the blood-stained gate. And he passes into it. Certainly he does. Right? And he tells you that right, this is it. And here's the tricky part. That this is also, right, as he said, as he tells you, he represents all other slaves. He's just like every other slave. Maybe they're not as stupid as their masters think they are. Maybe they're actually smart enough to convince their masters that they're stupid. To convince their masters, like, don't pay any attention. We're just ignorant. We could call it Uncle Tom and we could call it whatever we like. But what we've got is an incredibly intelligent, articulate man who expects you as a reader to be as intelligent and articulate, all the while giving lie to this idea that he's actually ignorant. He's certainly not ignorant, and he certainly wasn't back then. Right? Those slaves, they knew what was going on. They were well aware of what they had to do in order to survive. Right? So we've got those examples of slave songs, and we've got the supposed ignorance of the slaves. And then finally, at the tail end, we'll have that idea of the Sunday school as well. But that beating of his aunt, right? We expect ignorance because he's just told us all of that. We get intelligence and education. Amazing. And then we move, right, well, then that kind of the narrative thread leads us along to this kind of most fortunate event where he goes to Baltimore, where he realizes that city slaves have it much better than country slaves, right? If you live in the rural areas, why? Because your nearest neighbor in the country could be 5 miles away on the neighboring plantation. The slave houses are in the back. Nobody sees how you treat or mistreat your slaves. But in Baltimore, your nearest neighbor may be 6 or 8 feet away from your house, right? Maybe a little alleyway or some passageway between those houses. Everybody notices how you treat your slave. Everybody overhears it. And it becomes a sign of kind of your own wealth and your own ability to command that your slave is well fed, that your slave is well dressed, that your slave is articulate, respectful, yes, and things like that. But Douglas sees this as kind of this way out. And we start to see him make that big move, that recognition about education. And it happens because of his owner's master. I mean, because of his master's wife, Sophia Ault. If you remember her, right, she's the one who actually starts to teach him how to read and write. She, however, is stopped by her husband, who tells her in this screed that, I got to tell you, I used to read this to classes, but I can't do it anymore because it's painful to read it out loud. This idea that education is going to ruin a slave. Why? Because the slave doesn't have to just believe you, right? There'd be no keeping him, right? She commences to teach him the ABCs, and she starts to spell it, but then Mr. Ault strikes, right, and says, this can't happen, right? But then he says, he gained this right. He said, I now understood what had been to me a most perplexing difficulty, to wit, the white man's power to enslave the black man. It was a grand achievement, and I prized it highly. From that moment, I understood the pathway from slavery to freedom, right? And it's education. He says, knowing too much will make a slave discontented and unhappy. Well, good, because who wants to be contented being a slave? Right? And we see in, I think it's in chapter 7 there, yeah, when we start to see Douglas further his own education, become an autodidact. And it's great what he does here. He starts to, right, right. Sophia Ault turns into this kind of terrible woman. And granted, Douglas is a bigger man than I am, because when he begins chapter 7, he starts telling us about how he feels sorry for Sophia Ault, because look what slave owning did to her. Right? I mean, either the man is saint-like or totally ironic, and I'd rather believe he's saint-like, far more saintly than I would be.
He says, I feel sorry for slave owners because they twist themselves up in knots trying to justify what they're doing. They know how wrong it is, and yet they her to treat me as a human being was not only wrong, but dangerously so. How bad do you have to be full of self-loathing in order to think that treating other humans not as humans is a good thing? Slavery, as he says, proved as injurious to her as it did to me. But she was, in fact, she turns into this wretch. That doesn't stop him, though, when he's about 12 years old or so, to be working. What he does is he deliberately humiliates himself with these neighborhood kids so that he can learn to read. He starts, I mean, think about when you were 12, right? Did you want to lose games or bets or things like that with people you met, especially when you were exposed like that? Nope. You didn't want to do that, right? He wanted to learn to write. So he bribes the neighborhood kids. He engages them in contests that he deliberately loses so that he can learn something from them. What do we call that? And I think that's on your sheet as well. Yeah, we call that kenosis, right? Willing to humiliate himself in order to be elevated. Right? Biblically, thy humiliation shall exalt. It's the hymn of the Philippians, right? And that's what's going on here, is that he's willing to suffer because he wants something better at the end of that suffering, right? I'd tell that boy I could write as well as he, and the next word would be, I don't believe you, let me see you try it. And I would make the letters, right, and ask him to beat me, and then he'd write more, and I'd learn more. Right? And I would willingly suffer that defeat so that I could learn more. This is just kind of genius for him. And when we move to chapter 8, we start to see, we get to that second big narrative end goal. And if you're wondering about kind of the weight of this, right, you'd think that with three big spots like that, we're going to see this is going to be evenly balanced. But it's not. We've got 11 chapters here, basically. But chapters 10 and 11 are huge, right? So the whole kind of narrative weight of this autobiography is pushed toward the end. What looks like the center, the death of his grandmother, is, let's face it, he admits it, it's a lie. And he'll tell you it's a lie. And we'll pick up with that with the next podcast.